Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists. Keeping your business fleet moving with service you can count on.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes Cullerton, and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. Coming up on today's programme, how big is the blue economy and where does Ireland's marine territory sit in the world? Siri, powered by Gemini, took centre stage this week, but why are Europeans underwhelmed? Plus, could Iceland soon be joining the EU? You can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on socials at Susan Hayes Cullerton. So for my explainer this week, I wanted to pick up on something Christine Lagarde said after announcing the ECB interest rate increase on Thursday. She said the major energy shock is lasting longer than initially expected, so that's not a surprise. But she says it's now beginning to spill over into the wider economy. Now, that reference to spillover is significant, because if energy prices had simply risen and that was that, which was the case last quarter, she might have left interest rates as they were. However, and I'm quoting the ECB press release now, staff have revised up their baseline projection for inflation in 26 and 27, owing to a higher path for energy prices, which to some extent is expected to feed into food, goods and services inflation. That's the reason that the rate particularly was risen. That is the difference. So that spillover effect has led to her decision, and that's the one to watch out for when taking the pulse of the mood music of the ECB in the months ahead. So when you're looking out for how the ECB is going to make decisions, it's not just about one element of inflation, it's about how it spills over into others. Now, while we might have been focusing a lot on the EU's expansion to the east, and of course, a relentless focus on Brexit over the past 10 years, the real change which may happen to the EU is occurring at its northern fringe. Norway, Iceland and Greenland are currently having quiet conversations about how, and more pertinently, where they see their future. I'm delighted now to be joined by Jack Power, the EU correspondent for the Irish Times, to give us a whistle-stop tour of the word on the street in the Nordics. Right, Jack, big question to start off, first of all. Will you tell us the political and economic relationship of each of Norway, Iceland and Greenland with the EU as it stands?
Yeah, so basically, Greenland, for example, is still considered a territory of Denmark. So that kind of governs most of its relations. But when it comes to Norway and Iceland, they're part of what's known as the European Economic Area. So it's something that, you know, we probably don't hear too much about, but it means that effectively they're part of the EU's single market and common economic area. As a result, they're very kind of enmeshed in the kind of the EU system. They follow the vast heap of the EU rules and regulations that basically allows it to be part, allows both of them to be part of the single market. And so what's interesting now is there's a bit of a debate in Iceland about maybe going a step further and saying, well, will we have a conversation about joining the EU full in?
If they did, then they would be either influenced by or have an influence on things like fisheries, and we need to get to that in particular, agriculture, foreign and security policy. And even if they were to go further into the Eurozone, then membership of the Euro, interest rates being influenced by the ECB, etc. So this isn't a small decision, no more than any other country would be, despite the fact that they're further along in the EEA. Would that be an accurate way of describing things, or am I oversimplifying?
No, absolutely. And I mean, I think it's worth remembering that for Iceland, and that's actually something that people mightn't know, but they were, you know, well on the way to joining the EU a good few many years ago. They first applied for EU membership back in 2009. And because they were already part of, you know, the EU single market, things like the Schengen area, which allows border-free checks when you travel, that basically those negotiations moved pretty quickly at the time. But basically for a number of different reasons, in late 2013, Iceland decided to basically hit the pause button on its EU membership talks, in part because a more Euro-sceptic or less Euro-enthusiastic government took over. But also, you know, you remember at the time, you know, that was in the teeth of the financial crash, which Iceland were hit pretty devastatingly by.
Well, Jack, I have a particularly good memory of that indeed. And just to remind listeners, I mean, when Iceland went through the challenges that they went through, their exchange rate fell really significantly. Several of their banks went to the wall. They didn't socialise any of the debts of the companies. And of course, the other thing was some international bondholders, or sorry, deposit holders would have got burned as well. The reason I'm summarising this is that Iceland treated their financial crash very, very differently to how Ireland did. And one of the reasons was Ireland was a member of the Eurozone and indeed the EU at the time. All that said, that's in the past. And I'm not saying that anything like that couldn't happen in the future. But since life has moved on, do you think the conversation now would be influenced less by developments that were so in an Icelandic person's face at the time?
Yeah, I think it's, and I was chatting to a few people in Iceland for some reporting I was doing recently talking about this. And funnily enough, they were kind of saying that the debate in Iceland hasn't really kicked off in earnest. I mean, they're having a referendum this August, at the end of August, to basically ask the question, should we restart these EU accession negotiations? And so it's not a, you know, we're not at the point of an in-out question as you had with Brexit. It's a question about a vote to restart the talks rather than enter.
It sounds like they're having a referendum to have a referendum.
A little bit, yeah, because there will be another vote if this one goes ahead and they say, okay, grand, let's kick off back where we started talking with Brussels officials about the various different lengthy and winding negotiations that go into joining the EU bloc. And then after all that, the Icelandic government would effectively present whatever deal they'd got back to the people to say, okay, now here is what we have on the table. Should we become members of the European Union? And then that negotiation process, as I said, because they're already quite aligned, could be pretty quick, but there's some very big sticking points. As you said, the experience of the financial crash will probably still resonate with people, but the real big one is fish and fisheries. So at the moment, Iceland obviously has a huge economic area from which it can fish and fishing waters. I mean, that's one of their biggest and main exports. And, you know, part of the lifeblood of the Icelandic economy is their fishing sector and their fishing industry. So that's of most, you know, concern and the biggest point of anxiety of what would this mean for fisheries? Because at the moment, in their current relationship with the EU, they basically have an opt-out that says, yeah, we're part of the European Economic Area, but not when it comes to fisheries. So you'll imagine that there'd be quite a lot of pretty contentious haggling between Brussels and Reykjavik over where exactly the line is drawn, you know, how much extent Iceland would have to open up its fishing waters to trawlers from EU member states. And you can imagine the sensitivities there.
And of course, the other issue there too is that the EU is not known for its a la carte type membership. I mean, you're in or you're out. So when you talk about the haggling that would be there, that would be quite tactical. It doesn't sound like that would be strategic.
Yeah, and I think most people recognise that, you know, Iceland probably wouldn't be able to get, as you say, an a la carte opt-out to the fish to say, oh, well, we like everything else, but, you know, on this one point we're not joining, because, you know, that's not really how, you know, the EU's single market and the principle of the whole thing works. You can't have it all your way. So the question is, what kind of deal? And I think it's probably fair to say, you know, Brussels isn't keen about starting these renegotiations because it's going after Icelandic fishing waters. It's keen to restart these negotiations from a more wider geopolitical perspective. You know, the big orange shadow that's looming over everything is the Trump factor. And I think that has in some way played a part in Iceland and others, as you said, Norway, even Canada too. I mean, they're not in the queue to join the EU, but there has been a reordering of people's, you know, just how people and governments see the world and see their partnerships, their alliances because of how much Donald Trump has taken a wrecking ball to the old traditional alliances, the Western alliance, the transatlantic alliance, that really would have underpinned much of the world economy and the world kind of Western security infrastructure for the last, you know, how many years.
And I'd like to just move to Norway because you mentioned them for a moment. A quote here from Norway's foreign minister, Espen Barth Ide, she told Parliament last month, is we are preparing for the possibility that Iceland could be an EU member by 2030. That sounds pretty definite. How close is Norway to making a decision like that? Or even what is the mechanism for them to come to that conclusion?
I think one of the things that Norway in particular are worried about is that if Iceland votes in August to say, OK, let's kick off negotiations, as I said, those would probably be pretty quick. You know, maybe it'll take a year, it'll take 2 years. You're not looking at the kind of scenario that you have when states from the Western Balkans, you know, spend a decade, two decades trying to put in place the reforms and the economic modernization required to join the EU. So Iceland, there's a pretty good acceptance that it would move pretty quickly. And I think what Norway are worried about, I mean, there hasn't been much discussion about Norway starting EU membership talks, but what they're concerned about is if Iceland joins, what does that then mean for the EEA, the kind of the other kind of concentric circle? Because that's made up of, as I said, Iceland, Norway, and then, you know, the microstate, Liechtenstein. So if Iceland were certainly in the EU...
Is the question then, would the EEA become relevant anymore, or would that force Liechtenstein then to say, okay, maybe we should join as well?
Exactly. Yeah. I think that's what Norway are saying, that if Iceland are in, you know, the imperative for Brussels and the European Commission and the rest to kind of focus as much on the EEA and concerns that maybe Norway and Iceland would have in part of that, and their bargaining power would be a lot less if Iceland was in the EU. Norway would kind of be the only odd one out, you know, not really taking Liechtenstein into account because they're such a small country. And so I mean, it's interesting to see what and where and how that will shape the debate in Norway, and whether, you know, it does prompt some kind of rethinking of their particular relationship with the EU.
Well, whatever about the fish in Iceland, I'd imagine in Norway they're also being very considerate of their oil and, of course, the sovereign wealth fund. And look, every country is itself. Every country has its own culture and its own ways of being. And culturally, a nation needs to have a conversation about what that means for them. But I do want to return back to Greenland for a moment. Indeed, as you say, it is a territory of Denmark, but it caught the world's attention a couple of months ago when it caught Donald Trump's attention. Now, he's been busy looking towards Iran and Venezuela, etc. But how has that conversation shaped the role of Greenland, both within the territory of Denmark, but within the Nordic community in general?
Yeah, it's funny. And I remember I was in Brussels, obviously, during one of those, the kind of what was billed as a crunch summit of EU leaders at the start of the year, you know, just in the middle of Trump's threats over taking Greenland by force. And then in the end, I mean, you know, those few days were pretty frantic. You could kind of see people kind of huddling and diplomats discussing things in hushed tones and corridors. People were running here and there. And then in the end, you know, Trump basically backed down and the heat came out of the situation. But I think it's important to remember just the damage that did to Denmark and Denmark's, you know, previously really, really close relationship with America and also Greenland and Europe's kind of wider relationship with the US. I think if there was any lingering doubt about, you know, the lack of regard Trump gives to his European allies, you know, that was really the last holdouts of people who were kind of trying to keep up with this slight mirage that actually Trump is, his bark is worse than his bite. It has kind of prompted this, you know, reconsideration of Greenland and where they sit. And it's, you know, those talks have been quietly ongoing between the Greenland authorities, between Denmark and Washington, to come up with some kind of arrangement that, you know, would ideally head off the need for, as Trump sees it, him to own Greenland. Because what he's worried about is the Arctic Circle and Russia and China muscling in and influencing and interfering with our naval ships in that territory.
What I'm hearing you say is that we need to consider the relevance of EEA. We need to be watching for the 29th of August when we have the referendum about the potential referendum in Iceland. Norway is a new kid on the block in one way, but one of the most experienced members. Greenland is growing in relevance from a different geopolitical direction. But if there's one thing I'm absolutely taking away is that we need to make sure that we're turning our eyes north over the next couple of months, because if the foreign minister is looking towards Norway being a member of the EU by 2030, we need to keep our finger on the pulse and also just see how this also respectively shapes the shape of the EU as well. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today on Taking Stock. Thanks so much indeed. Jack Power, EU correspondent for the Irish Times. This is Susan A's Cullerton here on Taking Stock and News Talk. Up next, what was the verdict on Apple's moment of truth this week? You're welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Susan A's Cullerton. Now for my trivia this week. I was in a city a few days ago. I'm going to give you three clues as to where I was, and let's see if you can figure it out. John Boyd Dunlop invented the pneumatic tyre here in 1887. Sir James Murray invented milk of magnesia in 1829. And in that same century, this city earned the title Linenopolis. Now here's the giveaway answer. The tallest bar on the island is in this city. Have a think, and I will give you the answer at the end of the show. Well, outgoing Apple CEO Tim Cook hosted what's believed to be his final event for the tech giant on Monday. The WWDC, which is the company's annual software event, took place. And while there were many new features for iPhones and iPads announced, all European eyes were on the fact that they would not be available in this part of the world at launch. Now, our own Jess Kelly, News Talk's technology correspondent, is joining me now to discuss this. Jess, I was watching the build-up to this on Monday, and intriguingly, Apple had added $1.6 trillion of market cap since last year's event. Can you tell us what was announced on Monday?
This is the Worldwide Developers Conference. That's what WWDC stands for, just to save everybody the Google. And this is their software event every year. So for people like me, we set our calendars by Apple. So this time of the year is when we get the software updates. And then in September is when we get the hardware. So if you're waiting for your new iPhone, that'll be coming in September. And what they unveiled on Monday was a host of updates that will be coming to iPhone and iPads over the coming months. There was a lot of talk about trust and safety. So there were some features that focused on keeping your kids safe on their Apple devices, child accounts, how they work, why they work. We also got some new pretty cool camera feature updates as well. There's one that I spoke about on Tech Talk yesterday that I'm very excited about called Spatial Reframing. And this is an example of Apple's power and clout, because they're taking learnings from their Vision Pro, which is their VR headset, and putting it into the cameras. So say if I took a picture of you now sitting in the studio, but I wanted to get more of the studio in, I could replace or resize you in the image, and then the AI would fill in the gaps to make sure that the background was completely blended and looked normal. So there's a lot of exciting stuff there. But the key flagship announcement from this event was Siri AI. We have been waiting with bated breath to see what Apple will do in the world of AI. And we got a bit of an insight as to what their plans are. And it's named, not dramatically, innovatively, Siri AI.
And they've also decided to power this by Gemini. How significant was that as distinct to any of the other AIs that they could have picked, Jess?
I think it's interesting that they're using the Gemini models to kind of, that's the core AI brain power of this. And it is interesting. It, you know, usually Apple wouldn't even mention the word Google. There was, up until recently enough, this sort of closed off ecosystem within Apple, not only on the devices, but also in terms of you know, they didn't really look over the shoulder to see what the competition is doing. They didn't bother with what the competition is doing. So the acknowledgement and the acceptance of the collaboration with Google is significant, but it is worth noting that AI is, or Siri AI is doing its own thing. What they're saying, what Apple has said, is that Siri AI is its own product, and they've emphasized again the privacy and control that comes with having Siri on an Apple device. So there's definitely an interesting part here to the collaboration with Google, but it's very much in all of the demos that we saw on Monday and subsequently, it looks, sounds and feels like an Apple product.
So when we look back in history and we think about when the iPod was unveiled, the iPhone was unveiled, the iPad was unveiled, and even the iPhone 17 is currently the best-selling smartphone globally. There've been times when devices lived up to the hype, but there's been other times when they haven't, when the market has been left, I mean, the consumer market has been left underwhelmed. What do you think the, upon reflection, the vibe is now about the announcements? Was this a moment of truth for Apple or not?
I just think they're way too late to the game here, to be completely honest. Now look, Apple has always marched to the beat of its own drum. They were trailblazers. They were the first ones to come out with the smartphone as we know it today. They had the App Store, they had the iTunes Store, they had Apple Music, that they've constantly innovated. But when it's come to AI, they are absolutely late to the game here. And I think it's interesting to see how the market has reacted, but also, like, not to be a teenage girl about it, but how the vibe is around it. You know, the mood online, there was no real wow factor of a, I've never seen this before, or the competition will be blown away by this. That's just not the case. I think it's about time. I think if there isn't something dramatic coming from Apple in September with a new CEO and a new iPhone, there will be questions asked. Because, you know, I remember when the iPhones used to come out, you'd see people queuing around the block in Times Square, dying to get their hands on their phone. All of that has since gone away.
Well, we've talked about the consumer reaction. If we just talk about the stock market reaction now, because in the lead up to it, I was watching commentators say Apple is at 34, 35 times forward earnings. In many cases, that's merited by virtue of just how much of a machine it is in printing money, by virtue of how profitable its products are. And also, of course, Tim Cook is very much a supply chain optimization kind of guy. What is the stock market? What messages is it conveying now to Apple in response to what it has announced?
Well, it was interesting watching what was happening. There was a sense of anticipation as to what they were going to unveil. But by Tuesday afternoon, the shares had fallen around 3%, which is pretty significant. Again, there was an element of underwhelm, but there's also serious concerns about the fact that millions of iPhone and iPad users will not have access to what was the most exciting element of the Apple briefing, which is Siri AI, because of EU rules. And I think that that has caused the market to react. I don't think it's catastrophic, like these things are never going to be catastrophic, but there has been a sense of underwhelm, and that is reflected in the share price then as well.
So Europe is Apple's second largest market after the US. It accounts for 111 billion of sales in 2025. Can you tell us more about what Europe is not going to see? And also, is this Apple's fault? Is this the EU's fault? Is it a fault at all?
It depends on who you're listening to, because both sides have been very vocal in this. So just to break it down a little bit. So Siri AI, as I said, is the flagship announcement from this event, WWDC. And obviously enough, it's ingrained in the DNA of the Apple devices. What Europe is saying, let's start again. What Apple is saying, so within minutes of this press event ending on Monday, a post went up onto the Apple Newsroom website saying that this version of iOS and iPadOS will not be available in Europe at launch because of the DMA, the Digital Markets Act. They expressed frustration that the EU didn't want to collaborate in terms of finding a solution. They didn't negotiate or listen to the compromises, I suppose, that Apple was willing to work on to make this happen. That statement went out into the world. And then, very interestingly, the following day, the EU spokespeople for the EU came out and refuted that entirely. They said that Apple was simply unable to develop the interoperability solution that is absolutely required in terms of EU privacy and security standards. They're blaming the Digital Markets Act as sort of an umbrella term for this not going ahead. But what this means fundamentally is we here in Europe will not have access to Siri AI when it launches, and we will not have access to it until Apple finds a way to make this work within the confines of European rules. The key issue is that Siri, because it's ingrained in devices, it's not open to competition. So users will essentially be forced or have no other option but to utilize this AI, and iPhones and iPads aren't open to other competitors in the AI space if consumers decide they want that.
Like, that is tricky legal territory for sure. But I do like to, I'd like to zoom out a little bit here from the specific to the general. Is there a challenge that Europe, with its reputation for regulation, this is reinforcing it now. Does Europe hold back innovation in the name of regulation, do you think?
I think that is a question that I've been faced and have asked so many times over the last 2 years. I think those working in big tech spaces will tell you that, yes, it is getting in the way of innovation. There are too many boundaries and sort of security ropes put in place. But the point that I always come back to, Susan, and I've said this so many times over the years, is that when I was 16, I was on Bebo. I'm now 37. We are only getting to grips with the impact of social media all these years later. Legislation and regulation of social media is only coming into play now. We cannot afford to be in that position when it comes to AI because it is so transformational. So from a personal point of view, I'm in favour of the regulation and the legislation, because I do think it's designed to make the internet a safer, better place for everybody. And the pressure should be on big tech to be able to operate within the confines of rules that exist to keep people safe.
Well, Jess, you have really brought us around the world there from Cupertino all the way right back home via Bebo, in fact, which the only person I hear talking about that is you. Thank you very much indeed for joining me, Jess Kelly, News Talk's technology correspondent.
Thank you so much.
This is Susan Ace Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. After the break, how do we measure the blue economy and who is its economic stakeholders? Now you're welcome back to Taking Stock here on News Talk. I'm Susan Ace Cullerton. Now, before I introduce my next guest, I want to take a moment to acknowledge the plethora of historic events that took place this week. You know the phrase, sometimes there's weeks when decades happen and decades when weeks happen? Well, I think this has been one of the weeks when decades happened. For a start, we saw the largest IPO in history to date with SpaceX, and OpenAI filed its confidential SEC paperwork for its own respective IPO. The 2026 World Cup started off Thursday evening with Mexico versus South Africa. And this World Cup is the biggest ever, with 48 teams, three host countries, namely the US, Canada and Mexico, 16 stadia staging 104 matches. And then the ECB raised interest rates right across the Eurozone by 0.25% for the first time since 2023. And of course, we also had the 2026 Leaving Cert Economics exam this week too. Did you know that the real map of Ireland is 10 times bigger when you include the maritime territory of the country? And this week we had World Ocean Day. And given that 40% of the world's population lives at or near a coast, we've invited Mina Ipps, Global Ocean Policy Director at IUCN Centre for Policy and Law, to join us from Geneva. First off, Mina, will you give us a sense of the service that the ocean provides that enables so much activity, economic or otherwise?
Certainly. So the ocean really is central to our climate, our economy, our overall well-being. It stabilizes our climate, produces the oxygen that we breathe, and also is a fundamental for economic activities, whether it's shipping, tourism, offshore wind, fishing, etc. So it really is our life support system that we are depending on.
But yet it doesn't get the same attention at all as what goes on land. What do you think that the world is missing by not paying attention to what's going on under the water as distinct to what we can see on land?
Well, I think the perfect explanation is probably, first of all, out of sight, out of mind. And the ocean has been providing these services, which essentially have been taken for granted. These have been free assets, so to say, and we've been depending on them. But this is also very much changing from the viewing the ocean as an inexhaustible asset to really now the policy work is now looking at how do we deal with it as a finite one.
Can I just get a sense, before we get into the economics and the finance of it, the chemistry of the ocean, first of all, what or how has the ocean changed over however many years? Like, give us a sense of what exactly climate change is doing to the very composition of the ocean that we, as you say, take for granted.
Yeah, so the ocean is one of our biggest allies when it comes to climate change. So, but since we have continued to emit CO2 at a very, very large scale over the last, let's say, 50 plus years, the ocean, the pH value of the ocean is changing. So it's becoming more sour, essentially. So that's one thing, that if we keep emitting CO2, the ocean, which has provided a service of absorbing this excess CO2, it also changes the ocean. At the same time, climate change, as you know, is also making the oceans warmer. And warmer ocean also results in more extreme weather events, etc., as well as marine heat waves. So we're having increased ocean temperatures, which has a very distinct effect on ecosystem and their productivity, as well as something called deoxygenation, which is essentially that the oxygen level in the ocean is declining on average between 3-4%, but it can be much, much higher at a regional scale. So the ocean is becoming not just breathless, warmer and more sour. And that basically changes the whole composition in the ocean, and its health is therefore deteriorating.
I can imagine what warmer means. I can imagine what deoxygenated means. I have no idea what the ocean is getting sourer means and the consequence of it, though.
Yeah, so as the ocean absorbs excess carbon dioxide, it changes, it becomes more sour and in terms of a lower pH value. So for example, a lot of our organism, our invertebrates or shellfish, basically needs a certain pH in order to produce the calcareous, whether it's your oyster banks or anything else. So that basically means that it's just becoming sour, more acidic.
Okay. And if we then move to the sustainable finance that supranational governments are considering about how to either clean it up or make more out of it, as you say there yourself, make the oceans more productive, either in terms of what they're generating or the way in which they facilitate the transfer of goods from A to B. What does a supranational government organization need to consider when it comes to raising money to support initiatives like this, where the return on investment may not be immediate or even financial?
Yeah, so we look at the ocean as a whole. We often talk about the blue economy or the ocean economy. And if it was a single state, it would be like the seventh or largest economy. So there's no question about the ocean economy is growing. It's just, are we investing in the right type of activities that can then balance and basically provide the long-term benefits that we need? So I think that, first of all, awareness raising is really key, just because some of the services that we've outlined, because many can argue and say, well, you can still do shipping on a dead ocean, so to say, but there's so you have to look at it kind of interconnectedly. And I think the challenge is that the argument we often make in terms of investing in ocean health and resilient coastal ecosystem, etc., is that those benefits are often public benefits, so to say, whereas the investment, which often also requires you want to have the private return. So I think there is a big disconnect. So I think if you look at a kind of a global level, because the ocean, yes, we have our coastal communities to think about, but there's also the wider ocean and how do we work together with other governments to really protect the ocean? So everything from protecting marine environment is also climate policy, for example. So the ocean economy is growing. It's just whether we can make sure that we are investing in the right types of activity and ensuring the productivity for the long-term benefits. I think that is really one of the main challenge. And as you alluded to, is private investment often wants higher return on investment. If we're talking about 20-30%, that's something that's really challenging to get from, let's say, a conservation finance project, when it's usually much lower return on investment in financial terms, but the benefits far outweighs the initial investment. But those are maybe not to the same recipient. It's a public benefit. It's a collective benefit.
So do you think that there's different ways we need to measure holistic return on investment then, when you can look at the public benefits, obviously, that are available to all, or indeed the private benefits that may be available to entrepreneurship and business activity relating to the ocean? Do we need to look at this differently, Mina? Is that part of the challenge with bringing this conversation and elevating it to a more engaged level?
Yes, absolutely. I think first that the ocean, when we talk about ocean economy and investment, is not like a homogenous like group. It occurs in many different levels, right? So it can be the big industries, but it could also be small, medium-sized enterprises and local communities. So of course, you need different kind of policies, different investment for different types of activities in the ocean. And I think that, you know, once we start looking at the ocean and its services and everything it produces a bit more as the blue natural capital, if you like. I mean, for example, looking at nature also as part of infrastructure is a form of infrastructure that we need to invest in. So I think there's that kind of mind shift, but also there's a lot of talk about monetizing and putting a value on biodiversity and its services.
Can I also ask, though, who makes these decisions? Because water doesn't really recognise borders, for a start. And secondly, as I mentioned at the very beginning, the marine territory of Ireland is much bigger than the terrestrial territory of Ireland. And I can't imagine, we'll say, the Irish government coming up with or even executing any sort of legislation that would directly impact what is going on the land of France or Germany. But yet, when it comes to the ocean, I'm wondering, how exactly does decisions get made and executed? Is it that same sort of borders, even though water doesn't respect them? Or how is this done? Like, who owns them?
Well, that's a very good question, because 2/3 of the ocean is actually beyond national jurisdiction. So that means it's common heritage to humankind. So that actually belongs to no sovereign state, but it also belongs to everyone, including landlocked countries. So that's really a common good, if you like. And then there's something called the economics and inclusive zone, which is like 200 nautical miles from the shore, which a country then has a sovereign right for any economic activities that goes on in that area. Everything above that needs to be dealt with in like a multilateralism. So, for example, the different UN international frameworks. So there is, in the 80s, the UN established the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea, which is really, was originally there to kind of control and prevent harm. And it was done on a multilateral level, so within the United Nations.
Within that context of multilateralism, I'm interested to ask you how you feel Ireland is doing. And first of all, will you tell us, what is the BBNJ?
Yeah, so the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea, which really originally trying to look at prevention and control, was really, and then it had an internationally legally binding treaty, which was the UN Fish Stocks Agreement. So in terms of how do you manage fisheries on a global level. And then there was another internationally legally binding treaty, which looks at the seabed in areas beyond national jurisdiction. So, for example, both exploration, of potential minerals, but also how to protect the seabed floor. And under, let's say, the last 20 years, there's been negotiations to create an international legally binding treaty which protects biodiversity. So it's for the conservation as well as the sustainable use of ocean resources beyond national jurisdiction. So this treaty, which was negotiated at the United Nations, was adopted in 2023. And then following a few months later, it opened for signatures, which means that states, the aim is always to try to get universal ratification. States could sign the treaty and ultimately ratify it. And when 60 countries have ratified the UN treaty, it enters into force. And that happened on 17th of January this year. And what it is, the BBNJ agreement, is there to be able to create a legal framework so that you can establish marine protected areas. But it also has a way to have global modern standard for environmental impact assessment, which you didn't have before, as well as looking at the access and benefit sharing of marine genetic resources, as well as the capacity building and the transfer of marine technology. So those are the kind of four key elements. So this is really where we now have to move from a treaty on paper into implementing it. And a lot of this comes down to national coordination.
And that's where I'd like to understand where Ireland's position is on that.
Yeah, so Ireland has its own, every country has its own delegation, but the negotiation happens in different groups. So Ireland has been negotiating as part of the EU, European Union, and been very active throughout the negotiations, which then led up to the agreement being adopted. And Ireland was also one of the first signatories or early signatories in September 2023. And last year in September, it ratified the BBNJ agreement. So Ireland has ratified the BBNJ agreement and is participating actively in the negotiations and the preparatory work before the first conference of party, which would be in January next year. And Ireland, through its foreign aid, has also been assisting particularly small island development states or big ocean states that are also one of those most vulnerable. And so helping them to see how they can build their capacity for implementing the BBNJ agreement.
And so, Mina, I'd just like to ask you one last question before we finish up. Ireland is aiming to get towards 30% marine protected areas by the year 2030. And it's an objective that Fair Seas has been campaigning for actively. Would you be confident that Ireland is doing enough in order to make this possible?
Yeah, so, I mean, the first step is obviously to have the right legislation in place, whether it requires an amendment or a new law. I mean, I think that would definitely be a first step, as well as, and really, you know, making value of the very engaged civil society. I think that's key. So first, you need a legislation, you need the political will.
And we're just going to have to leave it there. Certainly, you've laid out the stall for where we need to start, for sure. Thank you very much for joining us, Mina Epps, Global Ocean Policy Director at IUCN Centre for Policy and Law. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, for the answer to this week's trivia. I was in a city a few days ago and I gave you three clues at the beginning of the show to see if you could determine which city that was. So here they are. John Boyd Dunlop invented the pneumatic tyre here in 1887. Sir James Murray invented milk of magnesia here in 1829. And in that same century, the city earned the title of Linenopolis. And here's the giveaway answer. The tallest bar in the island is in this city. So the answer is Belfast. And for those of you wondering where the bar is, it's the Observatory Bar on the 23rd floor of the Grand Central Hotel. And that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes Culleton. I hope you enjoyed the show and hopefully even learned something about economics and how it shapes the world around us. Quick reminder, the show is available as a podcast first every Friday morning on the Go Loud app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And of course, please do pop it into your WhatsApp groups for anyone else who might be interested. Taking Stock is also on air here on News Talk every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of the show this week was Aoife Breen. Research was by Stephen Daunton, Micheál O'Connell, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day, and I'll talk to you again next week.
Taking Stock with Susan Hayes Cullerton on News Talk.
With Nifty Business, the fleet management specialists, helping businesses unlock growth with a leased vehicle fleet.